Good morning. This is the Planning, Development, and Real Estate Committee, and call it to order. May I have a motion for approval of the agenda?
So moved.
Second.
Are all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. We have the minutes of April 24th meeting. Question?
Yes. On items A and B, action items, does not show who moved and who seconded.
Okay. These are minutes that are coming back to us on April 24th, and I think there were...
Question.
Yes.
Ms. Benjamin, are you looking at the meetings from April 24th?
Yes.
So?
Because mine does say who moved and seconded.
Okay, maybe you got adjusted between the two, between what we got sent and what I got.
Mine does not say. It just simply says a motion was made unanimous, committee unanimously approved. I guess the clarity that Mr. Benjamin is looking for is who made the motion.
Mine doesn't say that.
What page are you on?
3 of 84.
And it doesn't say under action item A? Is that what you're talking about?
Action item Roslyn Bus Alley.
Mr. Zimmerman moves, seconded by Ms. Hewlett?
Not in my version.
That's what ours said.
That's what mine said.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yes, it is. There we go.
We can get you.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
All right. You're okay?
Okay. Yeah, I'm okay.
So we all have same minutes, I guess.
We're okay.
If they're all the same, I'll move that they be approved as presented.
I do have one other issue.
Why don't we have a second and we'll have any other questions?
You seconded?
Second.
Actually, two other issues. One was on C, second paragraph. I do believe that it does state somewhere that there is, in fact, a local share associated. The very last line says only funds available through the grant process. Now, if the grant process includes money from Arlington, that's fine, but I believe Arlington is putting money into this.
If it's Royal Street, it's Alexandria.
Alexandria.
Oh, I'm sorry. Alexandria is putting money into this. Sorry.
There's Alexandria funding.
And I believe there is Alexandria funding. 0.85 million Virginia Department of Rail and Public Transportation. So I don't know what only funds available through the grant process means.
I think that...
Is that non-federal and federal?
Does that mean non-metro?
Yeah, I guess that's the question. I'm not quite sure what it means.
They're dedicated.
Yeah, I believe it was federal grant money that was the local match would come from the state.
I'm just wondering whether we want to clarify that sentence so that it says that.
Okay.
Federal grants plus local match.
Well, it's federal match plus the 0.85 from the region.
It does say it later on, except this one seems to contradict it.
Okay.
So can we say state and federal grants?
That's fine.
The local is the state.
That's fine.
Yeah.
That's fine. And I had one other request, and that is on D, the second paragraph. The second sentence, move it up to the first sentence and have it say, the benefits of any transfers should be evaluated. We're going to get back to that today.
Okay.
And then just say Mr. Benjamin also stated that.
Objection.
We have a motion and a second with the corrections. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, thank you. And the second set of minutes are from the 22nd. Is there a motion?
Move approval.
Second?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Moving to the agenda, for a time frame, yes.
But I just note that in between the two committee meetings, we're going to have a discussion about that's in the last week, and some people heard about this, just so people know we'll fall in between.
Okay, very good. We have an information item, but I think I'd better leave it. I wanted to think about changing it, but I think time frame will allow.
Well, Ms. Hedges, the consultant, Mr. Smart, who's here, has a obligation and needs to leave at 10:45. So we'd like to get the discussion on the Jackson Graham building in prior to that time, whether it's at the beginning of the meeting or somewhere else in the agenda.
Okay, we'll start moving and we'll try and move deliberately.
Okay, but, great.
Keep your request in mind.
Thank you.
Okay, the first item is the policy concerns using the use of the WMATA property for non-WMATA transit projects. And as you began this presentation, would you make sure the committee is back on where we are as to why we brought it, and did we review the procurement process and those things that were raised before? This is coming back to the committee with some questions asked.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. You ready? We can start talking.
Okay, fine, very good. I don't see what I'm supposed to say. Blue. So we came to you 2 months ago with a policy that was related at the time to the disposition of property at the Roslyn Rail Station that was linked to the a project that is a jurisdiction reimbursable project to construct a new station entrance there and high-speed elevators, and sale of our existing bus alley necessitated that. Related to that, we had put together a policy that would cover this kind of action where the sale of our property and the proceeds from that property would be necessary to and benefit projects that were investments in our system. And at the time, a few questions arose about the wording of the resolution that we'd proposed, and a request was made by you all that we provide some broader information about exactly how we, what the processes are that govern disposition of property. And so today we're coming to you to provide you that information about processes governing property disposition and ask you to approve the revised policy that reflects the input that you gave us 2 months ago. So moving on to the next slide, there are really two kinds of property that Metro has. One is excess property, the other is joint development. Excess property is property that could be acquired in any number of ways. The one here on the left, 11507 Georgia Avenue, was acquired for construction staging of the Glenmont line, and it is now it is vacant land. We have no operating requirements for it. It is excess. And the other is joint development, which and we're here illustrating that with the Navy Yard East station, where we are attempting to combine both transit operations and private development, transit-oriented development, at our transit operating facilities. Moving on to the next slide. For excess property, if there's property that we believe is excess, what we do is initially screen it to, first off, to establish that it is excess. And there are really two possibilities. One is that there's an internal need, in which case we reserve it for operations. And the other is that there is no internal need identified. We go ahead at that point and appraise it. We screen it then with the jurisdictions to see if there are any needs locally for that and give local jurisdictions the first opportunity to purchase it for their public needs. If the jurisdiction expresses interest, then we enter into negotiations based on negotiations from appraised value. If there's no jurisdictional need, then we go ahead and we can sell it at or above the appraised value. Moving on to the next slide. There are two ways that if we have an excess property and there's no jurisdictional interest and we're going to dispose of it by sale to a private sector, we have two possible ways of going forward. It depends on processes dictated by the characteristics of the property. Some properties we have are landlocked, they're small, they're adjacent to, they have no independent utility except to an adjacent property owner. In that case, we can negotiate the sale based on our appraisal of value with an adjacent property owner without having to go to competition. We do require board and FTA approval depending on how the property is acquired. If the property has independent utility, which means that it could be developed by somebody because of it has the right street frontage, right property depth, et cetera, then we can offer through any of a number of competitive means. There could be public auction, it could be a request for price proposals, but in that case, we sell it to the highest bidder. There's not a joint development process with this approach. It's really a price-based approach. Again, FTA and board approval required. FTA, depending on how the property was acquired. Moving on to the joint development process, we've had recently a lengthy discussion of the revision to the joint development guidelines, and so really the way that this works is you dispose of it according to the joint development guidelines. So we can revisit that if the board has questions about it, but I think we treated that pretty exhaustively recently. The recommendation that we have is that the board approve the policy allowing no-cost transfers of WMATA-owned real property, as we've described in the last meeting, with the following change that we include a requirement that the property, that the transit benefit to Metro be commensurate with the value of the property. That is the principal change that was made. And we were also requested to define in recitals or in the resolution to what properties that applies, and we've done that as well. So with that, the presentation is concluded.
Any questions? Is there a motion?
I think the proposal is consistent both with the intentions of our overall policies regarding development, but also particularly consistent with the new approach to construction that the agency has taken over the last year. So I move its approval.
Is there a second?
Second. I would like to discuss the resolution, please.
Do you have a friend? Yes, go right ahead.
In this resolution, one of the things, I do appreciate the changes, and they were in the direction that we talked about. One of the things that's included in here is it says, in a couple of places, that this project has to enhance authority transit operations. I'm wondering why we're limiting it only to authority transit operations and not general public transportation, or public transit operations.
I think it's an issue of keeping a tight relationship between benefit to the authority, and that language could be lax somewhat, but I think it was to maintain a, you know, we're disposing of authority property. I think that allows for us to make a finding that a more general transit improvement is in the authority's interest, but I think it's keeping clear the principle that it's the authority's land, and I think we want to be starting from that point of view.
I guess following on what Mr. Zimmerman just talked about, take the example of the fact that the district is now looking at a number of potential light rail lines. If they were to use a piece of authority property for a light rail line that they would build and then operate, wouldn't that be commensurate with the idea that we're trying to put together here?
I think it would
have to be authorities.
I don't think that to the authority's benefit necessitates it being the authority's project.
But this is the authority transit operations. You have to stretch a little bit more.
It is a little bit more of a stretch, but I think that, for example, if the district were providing a transit facility that were duplicative or additional to a service that we provide, mm-hmm. then it could be beneficial in terms of providing relief to that. So that's a benefit to WMATA's operations. I think that we could include it in that envelope.
I guess I hear your argument, and I can buy that if that were always the interpretation. I can see somebody in the future saying, no, it has to directly affect the authority's operations, and the fact that this is operated by the District of Columbia says that, no, it isn't directly affecting us. So I wonder if we want to make it broader and make it public transportation.
Question. Yes, Mr. Zimmerman.
I was going to ask if, in place of the word authorities, wanted something like regional transit operations.
Yes, that would be fine, I think. Now, the question I guess I have is that so broad that you could drive a truck through it? But it seems like it should be a little bit broader than where it is, because we ought to be supporting public transit, even if it isn't our own public transit.
And we concur, and that's the intent. We do wish to do that. In fact, we had specific discussions concerning the district system, as well as proposals in Virginia, as well as in Maryland, particularly the Purple Line. So our intent was that we would make accommodations and those type of use of our land.
But could we then accept Mr. Zimmerman's suggested change?
Is there a question over on that? Okay. Yes.
Just to add to that, I think that makes sense, because remember that this is still something that would come to the board. The board still has the opportunity to say that it doesn't make sense for some reason, and any jurisdiction can stop something from happening. This at least puts the focus where I think Mr. Benjamin rightly intended it, which is our goal really here is to promote transit in the region, not a self-interest for just this agency.
Okay.
And if you could actually take that and make it one of the little Roman numerals, it would also, at least in my mind, read a little bit better, because it is one of the first criteria that you would apply as opposed to part of your introduction. I particularly like the way you worded number three. That was very good. Is there a need here for something that prevents one of us jurisdictions from just flipping the land, something that says that if in fact we get it under these conditions for transit operations, we have to maintain it, sort of like the federal government does, for at least some minimum time in transit operations.
And I don't know if I'm legally we could put that in here, but I would imagine any agreement that we put in as part of the agreement process would require that it can only be used for transit operations, and it would revert back if we were giving the land. But generally, I think it would be an easement in most of the cases.
I like that explanation. Can we somehow embody that in here?
We reflected that principle in the joint development guidelines, but we hadn't applied it to the disposition of excess property, of properties under these circumstances.
I think that's that.
Yes.
You could add just, you know, words that said and will be maintained for transit purpose or something like that. Maybe you don't need to craft it today exactly. But
right, right. And finally, I had a question on number two, the Arabic number two. I was curious about why these funds had to go back into just that particular project and couldn't be used somewhere else by the authority for another authority project.
Or could it go to the TIF fund.
Or go to the TIF.
Yeah.
Are you saying that this is describing that this happens and it doesn't necessarily happen? So you give us the option to take another way, but Do we have the option of using it?
This one, as I read it, says, if we receive funds from a non-governmental source, they must be applied to that particular transit project or that particular reimbursable. I was trying to figure out why we had that limitation on it. It could be that there's a good reason for it. I couldn't figure out what it was.
I think what's intended there was, if you're letting me in my jurisdiction take this piece of land for the transit purpose, you don't as a regional interest, you don't want to just basically hand me the money to do whatever I want with. It otherwise would go into the TIF.
It's related to
be regionally distributed. So the idea is you're letting me do that because I'm trying to make an improvement that is specific to that you understand what it is. I thought that was the idea.
But this says that if we, the authority, receive money as a result of this process, we have to turn around and put it back into your project. Mm-hmm. And the question is why? Why can't we put in any project that makes sense to the board?
In which case, we could say, or the TIF.
Or the TIF, or...
Which is any project.
I'm even wondering what this does for us. Because it constrains the authority and the authority's use of funds. Now, there may be a good reason to constrain the authority's use of funds. I'm not...
Okay, well, then let's ask the question this way, if I may. I understand what I was just talking about made sense if it said, if the sponsoring jurisdiction, which is, yes. I thought what you're trying to get at. The question is, why did someone think it was a good idea to insert the words, the authority or...
Yeah, if it were written the other way around, that would make a lot of sense with the sponsoring jurisdiction.
I'm actually asking the question about why the words were included, assuming somebody had something in mind that I'm not thinking of.
Yeah, that's the same question I was asking. Why is this here?
Looking to the three individuals who were involved in it.
Chairman, my suggestion, we just delete the words, if the authority or. So it would simply be if the sponsoring jurisdiction. Provided that if in the next 2 weeks somebody remembers some important reason that was done, they'll come back to corrective language before the board.
Just an alternative, delete the entire item? Because it doesn't, does it add anything?
I think the rest of it does. The rest of it says, you know, if your jurisdiction wants it, we'll let you do it. But the only reason we're not saying the money goes into the TIF is because you're putting these resources directly into the transit benefit.
So it says if the jurisdiction receives. So instead of the authority, it's the jurisdiction.
Right.
Okay.
So the language will be reflected as the sponsoring of jurisdiction?
We need to probably just change a few of the words, but we understand what you put the word is going to go.
If this motion passes, you will come back with
the correct word.
And I ask procedurally, would we come back to the board later this month, or would we come back to
the board? Yes, no reason not to bring it in, but show the edits, reflect the intention.
Just give us a chance to see it before you suddenly handed to us and say,
or can deliberate it to
yes,
the same people. So.
Answer the question then. Any other questions? Okay, hearing none. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Anyone opposed? Thank you very much. The next item is the bus network evaluation.
I believe Mr. Hughes is going to make the presentation on this.
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. We had a brief conversation about this at the last committee meeting last month. Purpose of today's presentation is a request that the committee recommend to the board the acceptance of our bus network evaluation report, validating the need for the extra buses. A little bit of background, I won't read everything on here. Metro Matters agreement provided for the acquisition of 185 buses. It was assumed a distribution shown on the chart. The board approved the acquisition of the first 50 to be included in Metro Matters, and that any before any of the additional 135 buses could be purchased, we had to do a bus work network evaluation to do the justification for it, and we have subsequently done that, and now we're bringing it back to the board. Study approach. We took all of our study effort. We used a consultant. We talked to the jurisdictions. We actually evaluated all of our existing services to see where we saw both the need for growth, some room for reductions of service, but we looked at all of the existing metro network in terms of what service was provided in the ridership level. We also looked at new service patterns that were emerging, both the priority network corridor network that we presented last month, also new service needs that are emerging in the area, some of that related to the relocation of the federal government agencies. We put all this together, analyzed the number of buses. We also looked at garage implications because more buses requires more space. You've heard that. We don't necessarily have a space in the right place for all of them. And we also looked at and made it match the updated fleet management plan, which came to you last 18 months ago, January 07. Next slide, please. What we found when we went through all that detail was that it justified the 185 buses. And in fact, the detailed analysis says we need 195, slightly more, off by 5%. But the conclusion of the report is 185 is the right number. So that what we're recommending is that the board accept the finding of the best bus network evaluation report, validating the need for all 185 buses. And that by the requirement of Metro Matters, we notify everybody that we've done this analysis and then it's been accepted by the board. This acceptance of this report doesn't commit any funding requirements to the board. It's similar to a fleet plan. This is what our needs are as we roll out our capital programs. We'll make sure that it's in here, that it matches this, and so that as we come forward year after year, this is just another plan that supports our capital program. So all those next steps, if you accept the plan today or at next 2 weeks board meeting, then we'll notify everybody. We'll develop the phase implementation of these 135 buses, and then we'll put it into the capital improvement program, which you'll see later this summer. And we'll go back, and we still have to do the garage expansion program, which will also be in the capital improvement program. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hughes. Questions? We've had a very thorough presentation earlier, Mr. Benjamin.
As I think we all said in the last presentation, this is a really good plan. Very, very well done, very thoughtfully done, nicely put together, and we in the state of Maryland are anxious to move ahead with it. That having been said, we do have one concern, and it's the same concern that I voiced last time. That is, we do not have enough money at this point to do all the bus replacements that we say we need. I know that if we approve this, we are not saying that we're going to buy the 135 buses. But what I don't want to do is get into a situation where we say, well, board, because you've approved this, you now have to have extra money for replacement buses because all of these are going to be going for the expansion buses. And I know that there will be limitations on what can be done in this program unless we do buy some of those expansion buses. And as I said, we're anxious to do it. So I'd like to add into the resolution somewhere something that asks the staff or says, before you come back to us and ask us to buy some of these expansion buses, that you will do a trade-off of using the money for expansion buses versus using the money for replacement buses. and you'll be able to assure us that you can live with this money going into expansion buses.
Question.
Follow up to this, yes.
Does the Metro Matters funding agreement permit the use of those funds for placement of existing buses?
No. And but the concern I have is we still have the flexibility to do something about that. Is that right, Carol? I don't think it does allow that flexibility because it does define the two categories. Right, right. But we do still have that flexibility to do the amendment, and the concern I have is once we spend the money, we spent the money. So as anxious as I am to move ahead with this, I also would like to get reassurances that we aren't just turning around and creating another need in the basic service that we're providing, because we won't be buying as many replacement buses as we say we need, because we discovered that we didn't have enough money for that. That's going to increase the average age of buses, and that's going to cause staff to come back to us and say, you know, our bus age is going up after we just managed to drive it down, which is a legitimate statement. I just want to have them look at it and come back to us and say, we can handle both.
You referenced a point in the resolution for clarity, and I think that you should point out where you'd like to see that. Yes, the response, Mr. Volpato.
I just wanted to communicate, as part of the capital improvement program that we're bringing back to the board later this year, included in that will be the bus replacement plan. Understanding that we start to identify some of those funding sources, but our intent from a long-range perspective and the overall plan is to have that bus replacement as well as the bus expansion that's identified in the Metro Matters. But so that's there.
What you're saying is you are going to give us something. Yes, we need more money. Are you going to say we need both? Is what you're going to come back with?
Yes.
Are you following up on that question?
I have comments to make on it, but
just a real quick question/comment. I know one of the things that the district, again, very supportive initiative, very much fundamental with what we're trying to do as a city, so we're very supportive. One of the things that we're really interested in looking at on a corridor-by-corridor, route-by-route basis, looking at the need or the potential to be able to actually reduce the number of buses there so we can essentially swap out the older buses, thereby keeping the average age of the fleet still where we want to keep it. If we're providing more capacity along the corridor, maybe we're in a position where we can bring on new buses, reduce the number of buses we're running on those corridors, but still keep the average age of the fleet. I think we'd like to really drill down on a corridor basis and see if we can not lose the intent, both intentions, one, new service, and then two, not drive down the average age of the fleet.
I appreciate Mr. Benjamin's caution on the financial side, but I think I maybe disagree with where he's going. Number one, the staff can't assure us they're going to have the money. Of course, we make that decision directly, but send us here. And what all the staff can ultimately do is say, no, we don't have enough money, and here's how much we need for this, this, and this, and here's the bill. We decide whether we want to pay it or not. But I'm concerned that we seem to throw up roadblocks to bridge to buses more than anything else. And historically, the agency didn't want the bus system in the first place, and for a lot of years ran it that way. And at one point, it looked like it was going to completely collapse, and then it sort of stabilized. And then there was some kind of commitment to at least maintaining the fleet we have, and the fleet had gotten incredibly old, and now has gotten younger and younger, frankly, with replacements that we have been doing over the past decade. And we've even grown a little service here and there. But when we did Metro Matters, again, it started out, frankly, like everything, you're focused on the rail system. And some folks rightly said, if you're saying we need to be able to increase within our service area, not just this, Metro Matters wasn't about new extensions here and there, but it was really about how does the system meet growing demand within the existing system. Isn't that true on the bus side as well? That's why some improvements, including a new facility and some new buses, were provided for. But we still had those who insisted, well, we had to do another check on the buses. Would you really need them? I'm not sure that if the folks who are on the board now were doing this agreement, that we'd have had that requirement. The people who were then sitting in, well, the seat that Mr. Benjamin occupies, weren't necessarily interested in expanding bus service, but were looking to go the other way. And so we had to put up this next hurdle, that even though, of course, the rail money would all flow, the buses, they'd let them have 50, and then they have to go back and say, do you really need them? Now, frankly, with the growth in demand for our service year after year after year, even before we hit this spring's sudden escalation in fuel and fuel costs and gas prices, it's not really a serious question. We could hand these folks 1,400 more buses, and I have no doubt that they could fill them, no doubt at all. So it really is a question about whether we're going to go ahead and raise the level of service in the face of growing regional economy, growing demand, and, you know, the new circumstances that are even more intense than they were before. And that's why it was locked in the agreement, that you couldn't take the Metro Matters money and divert it to other stuff that you should have been doing anyway, because basically we're trying to maintain the effort of all the jurisdictions to things like replacing what we already have now. And I think that's as true on the bus side as it is on the rail side. So we can decide, of course, when it comes to it, that we just don't want to spend the money, or we, you know, don't think we have the resources, and we don't go through with Metro Matters. I'll fulfill it. I don't think that's a choice we should make. But that's really our decision. It's a jurisdictional decision and ultimately a board decision of whether we want to provide those funds. I think it would be a huge mistake to do so, given everything we know about what's going on in our world right now. So we have the opportunity now to start for the first time really historically in making a substantial increase in the effort of transit service on the bus side. It seems to me it's the right time to move forward and the wrong time to be throwing up more obstacles to our moving forward. That's my opinion.
Thank you. I just want to have one of a comment that one of the next steps is to develop the implementation plan, and that would be coming back to us.
Yes, it would.
And that gives us an opportunity to determine, according to your phasing of how you do this, as to what the cost would be, how you would fund it, et cetera, at that time. Is that the understanding?
That's correct.
I just wanted one comment. One part about this plan to me is that it makes our public recognize the balance of transit in this area, that buses really are critical. And what you presented to us before was that we really do have an opportunity to expand services to people, not just through rail, but through improved bus services. And that use of the additional capital buses is very critical to that part. So I think we should be careful here. But I think the most important part is that we should be celebrating the fact that we're moving forward on something that's really critical to the region and working with the other regional partners to do that. You had another question, Mr. Benjamin.
I just wanted to follow up on Mr. Zimmerman's comments, because I think it's important to realize that what we are looking at here is what we all love to do, which is do something new, different, and better. And we need to do things that are new, different, and better, and that improve service for our public. But one of the keys to what Mr. Zimmerman was talking about is at one point, we were letting our basic bus system go into the ground. We were not replacing buses. We were not fixing our bus garages. We were not taking care of a very, very important part of the public transportation network. And the concern I have is that in our rush to do something that's new, wonderful, and exciting, we start to slip on the commitment that we made to get the average age of our bus fleet down to 7.5 years, and I believe it's now below that a little bit. All I want to do is make absolutely certain that in doing this, we don't lose our basic service. We don't start to compromise the service that we give every day to our existing passengers. And yeah, you know, if there were unlimited funds, I'd say, sure, let's do everything. All I want to do is make sure that as we go through this, we balance those two issues. And you're right, also, balance that against potential money that might go to rail.
We can reply, yes.
It's, you know, I agree with Mr. Benjamin entirely about the need to maintain the commitment to the age of the fleet, maintain the fleet we have. But I really don't agree with the characterization of this as new, different, and better. We are talking about some new, different, and better things. We are talking about, you know, in fact, some of the things we have later in the agenda go in that category. Some of the new things like bus service and, you know, in Maryland, the district is in the new, different, and better category. This is just buying more buses. I don't think this is new, different, or better. I think this is actually saying, again, what Metro Matters said was, we know we're going to have this growth. How do we accommodate it within the system? So we need to put money into investing in, you know, being able to run 8-car trains, which means having the cars and having the train control capacity and the power capacity to be able to run those, and some other kinds of improvements so you can actually just absorb growth. And the same thing's happening on the bus side. And as my friend to my right reminds me, that in some of our jurisdictions, those two things aren't separate, they're together, because the way those more people are getting to the trains, in many cases, is on our buses, which, by the way, we'd much rather they do than be driving their cars there. So, to some degree, this is simply providing additional vehicles to carry the increased load where we're already carrying it. And so, you know, again, the caution is not wrong, but I don't want to lose track of, this actually isn't doing something that's particularly new and sexy. We have that going, too, but this was really about, does growth in our system mean that we're going to need an extra 185 buses? Looks like the answer is, yeah, 185, without doing a whole lot of new, different, and better stuff.
Okay, we have a motion on the table. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much to the bus riders here at the sidewalk. Very quick. The next item is the on-call engineering services.
Sergeant Dave Couch will be making that presentation.
Thank you.
David?
Good morning. The purpose of tomorrow's briefing is to present the FY09 annual work program for our on-call engineering consultants. This provides a series of benefits and cost trade-offs as we go through. It avoids having us to have a larger engineering staff to be able to do these designs in-house, and it also provides a better breadth of resource response when it comes to technical capabilities that you normally would not have in a smaller staff. By way of background, in 2005 there were three new on-call consultants that were entered into, one for the general architectural and engineering services, which really was Metro Matters at that time. The second one was support for vehicle engineering. The 2-3K, the 6K series, and then looking at the 7K. And the last one was really a planning and a new starts, the expansion to the system. By way of all of this, as every year goes through, the funds are committed as the individual task orders are defined and issued. The next several slides give examples of the types of designs that will be done. Under the next slide, the power projects is something that we do to maintain a state of good repair. And the page after that are tunnel liners, which are things that are necessary to maintain the structural integrity of the system and maintain proper operating conditions. For the first contract in FY09, which is the general architectural and engineering section, there are a series of items. $14 million that really are a compilation of examples that were on the previous couple of slides. The continuation of the engineering support for the traction power upgrade to achieve the 50% 8-car train goal. And then a series of smaller tasks that comes to a total of $22 million for that particular consulting firm for this year. The next page is the vehicle engineering program. The first item is a series of all the normal vehicle programs. It's the completion of the 2 and 3K. It's the bus support that's needed for the continuation of the bus program. It also includes things with the Metro Matters program for the 6000 series and the 8-car precision stops. The third consultant really is the futuristic consultant. It's the one that was originally termed for New Starts. It will be utilized this year for the bus corridors planning program. It also will be used for some of the ridership forecasting that's been provided under separate presentations that Mr. Hughes has done over the last several weeks. So that accounts for $3.5 million to that contract this year. All the funds for the professional services contract are contained in the budget. Or some of them are carryover from prior years. There are some that are FY08 in terms of reimbursable projects.
And the recommendation is for the committee to approve the annual program and forward it to the board for their action at the next board meeting. That concludes the presentation, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Crouch. I just had one question I have regarding. These are moving forward on options?
It's a five-year contract. We're in the fourth year of the five on all of those. They were started, particularly the on-call that was there for the P2D contract. They're all set to be in the same term as the Metro Matters program. So next year in FY10 will be the last year of each one of these contracts.
And have these been consistent for how long, or have there been other service providers within that contract?
Within each one of these contracts, there are a series of sub-consultants. For example, the P2D conglomerate has got 40-some-odd sub-consultants. As an entity, the P2D, this is the first time that we've had them on board. The Parsons portion of it has been here from the inception of the system. They were our original general engineering consultant that started back in the 1960s. As we finished the build-out of the new construction, that contract was completed and closed, and we then started with the new on-call program for the rehab projects. We have had the Booz Allen as a contractor before on the vehicle side, and they've been on board under various contracts for about the last 15 years. Prior to that, we had a company called LTK Clowder that was the vehicle consultant. So we've had a variety of different ones over the years.
Any other questions?
I do. On page 54 of the Vehicle Engineering Support Services, I want some clarification on the system expansion program, the $1.3 million in rail car engineering support, including the Anacostia streetcar procurement support.
That 1.3 is really a roll-up. This is a high-level presentation. There is about 130,000 in that 1.3 that is for the tasks that we have this next fiscal year that are associated with that program.
Okay. Is there a motion? I will move it.
I'll second.
Maybe. Okay.
I do have a question.
Your question.
When we're approving this, are we also approving this resolution on the project development program, or is that a special separate item?
We're moving the resolution for...
Just on the on-call engineering?
On the engineering. Yes. I think I have this one,
but the project development. Maybe different in the book. Something in your package is project engineering.
Yes. I think we may have a writing here. That's it. You don't have the correct resolution for the item.
So what are we approving?
We're approving engineering contracts to refer to the board as supplied. But I don't see that.
It's the wrong resolution.
It's the bus resolution.
There's no resolution for it.
Okay.
Well, and I have the package that you originally sent out, and it has the FY 2009 Project Development Program resolution. Very confusing. What are you asking us to approve?
I apologize for the package. I mean, what we're asking for is moving to the board to approve these, adjusting
the resolution.
Correct.
There is a meet associated with the on-call. There is no resolution for this action.
Okay. So we're not being asked to do the 09 project development and network evaluation we've already done.
Question. I'm not clear with that. Wait a minute. We will either have to have a resolution, or we can come back with the appropriate resolution, or do you want to wait until the board?
There is a need for this action, Madam Chairman, that would substitute for the resolution.
Right, I mean, this, Madam Chairman?
Yes.
Is the statement then that the action does not involve a resolution at all?
Correct.
It just simply the board directs the approval of the work plan.
And what would the wording be then? If it's one sentence direction, what is it?
No, it simply is moving forth the on-call engineering request. That's the approval.
Board will have to have an action, so what would be the motion that the board would be acting upon?
That's what we said.
The board action information summary would be the action document that the board would receive.
I'm sure they'll give us such a thing, but the board action is not the staff paper. The board action is a statement. It is a motion.
That was the motion.
Which would then have to be described in something, so it would have to say as described in. And Chairman, I move that the committee forward this to the board without recommendation.
That's fine. Is there a question? Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. All those in favor of just moving this till we get to the board with a recommendation to come at that point? Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? I think this is still on. Okay, the next item is Rhode Island Avenue. Yes, joint development.
Mr. Bottenheimer will speak to that.
About a year and a half ago, the board approved a compact public hearing report for the Rhode Island Avenue project that required that 150 spaces be maintained at the Rhode Island Avenue station site during construction, and another 50 be maintained in an interim location that was approvable by Metro. We and our developer partner have been evaluating this and working on this, and together conclude that it would not be feasible to proceed safely and expeditiously with the construction with the terms of the compact public hearing requirement. And so we have come to you today to request your approval to waive the compact public hearing requirement to maintain 150 long-term parking spaces on the Rhode Island Avenue site, and to request a board approval that authorizes us to work with the developer directly to come up with a suitable alternative. And we wanted to talk to you about a couple of alternatives that are available to us. There is no agreement yet on exactly what the approach is. And just in terms of timing, we basically need to get an agreement with the development team before the end of July, probably before the first half of July, because the developer financing depends on public financing called new market credits. They expire at the end of July, and so we and the developer are anxious to resolve this quickly. Next slide. Just to give you an idea of the location, here we are on the red line. The Union Station is to the south, New York Avenue is to the south, Brookline CUA to the north this way. This is Rhode Island Avenue extending to the northeast, and here is our parking lot facility right here. It's relatively small. We've got a site. We've got 6,000 boardings a day. 40% of them are bus. 22% of them are park and ride. The remainder are walk up, drop off, and so on. Next slide. The first option that we are looking at and was proposed to us by the development team was to have an interim parking lot located here. On the other side of the CSX tracks, west side here, and the idea was for the developer to provide a shuttle that would circulate from here out to Rhode Island Avenue up and to here. And one of our concerns about this, and Chief Taborn is here and has been actively involved in assessing that, is safety concerns with this location, lighting, the isolation, there were public safety hazards, and in addition, there is an existing issue with transit patients crossing the tracks here at grade and coming to our facility and getting onto a path that then takes them grade separated across Rhode Island Avenue into our station. If you're at the Rhode Island station right now, practically any time of day, you can look down, you can see people walking across the CSX tracks, and we are very uncomfortable having our patrons, basically moving parking patrons to a location where we'd be giving them incentive, if for some reason the shuttle service was not adequate, to walk across the tracks. The second option is basically to eliminate long-term parking for the duration of construction. This is, I'm sorry, this isn't oriented the same way as the previous slide, but this is now going north to Silver Spring. This is Rhode Island Avenue looking to the southwest towards Union Station. And this is an elevation view of the development project. Basically, the proposal is to allow the construction of the private and public elements of the project without park and ride, maintaining bus operations, maintaining kiss and ride, and ADA access through construction, and the developer paying us for the revenue that we would have gotten from parking spaces if they were in operation during construction. This is the option preferred by WMATA staff of the two here. It's, I guess, at least worst. There is a third option that we have identified during the course of the last week in conversations with the District of Columbia, which could we go back to one of the aerial slides? Thank you. The district is in the process of constructing a grade separated pedestrian bridge to connect this side of the tracks into our Rhode Island Avenue station. I don't have the exact location of it, but I think it connects in approximately here. This is to connect with the Metropolitan Branch bike trail, which is going to be constructed along this stretch and will eventually connect New York Avenue to Silver Spring Station. This bridge is expected to be finished and open to the public roughly in the middle of the construction period. So one of the opportunities potentially is to shut down parking for the first part of construction, and as soon as the bridge is open, to permit interim parking here. That addresses the crossing issues of the CSX tracks. It doesn't fully address the public safety concerns of that location. What we imagine from that option is that this would buy us time to work with district transit police and the developer to fully address, whether it's with cameras or some other security cameras or some other lighting solutions, to address the concerns that are there. Go on to the last slide now. The request at this point is that the board waive the compact public hearing requirement and that we are authorized to execute either an interim parking agreement or eliminate long-term parking, or another option that minimizes the impact to the patrons who use that that parking lot at the moment. There's no presentation.
Are there questions or
a motion? A motion so moved.
Question?
Yes.
What is the duration of the construction project? I don't see that in here. How long are we talking
the
about?
The duration of the overall construction project is 26 months, and the time to replace the Metro parking garage is scheduled for 14 months.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
In terms of the staff recommendation to eliminate long-term parking, how do you think that would affect the ridership?
Well, there's no question that it would be a disruption, and we're very mindful of that and concerned about that. In this case, there's just a trade-off between wanting to preserve it and not wanting to put people into a location where...
I understand that, but I'm just trying to figure out and get an answer in terms of any projected adverse ridership impact if you eliminate the long-term parking.
We eliminate it, it's 22% of our riders who go to the Rhode Island Avenue station arrive by park and ride. So it's one-fifth of the sixth.
Do you think that the entire 22% would be adversely affected?
Well, I think that...
Would people park some other place at another station?
The answer is I don't have a quantitative estimate for that. I think people will find alternatives. There's bus access. Some of them may choose to walk. Some of them may choose other routes. I wish I could tell you that number. I don't know.
I'm sure it seems to me that that's a very important factor in the decision. I understand the concerns about security at the interim station, but you didn't recommend that. You recommended eliminating the least one, I remember, right?
Correct.
And that's, so I don't know what we do about that. Seems to me we need to at least get some preliminary idea. I don't know whether a survey or whether, I don't know how to do this, but it seems to me that 22% is a big
I recall that half of them are from the district, half from Maryland, further out along Rhode Island Avenue. I mean, I know that there are bus routes along Rhode Island Avenue that are options, but we just haven't gotten to that.
Another issue, Madam Chair, is how close or how far apart are you and the developer on any of these options? I mean, it's going to be a difficult situation to come to a conclusion, or are you close to it now?
I think based on our conversations with the developer, they're all resolvable, but we wanted to get direction from the board on which direction is preferred, because we know that whatever decision we take has significant impact, public impact.
I mean, I asked that question yesterday. I got a call from the developer. I have not talked to him yet because I was doing other things. I wanted to be at least find out at this juncture the attitude of the authority and the developer about coming to a solution.
I don't see any. Everything that we are working on, we think, is resolvable.
But you, how do we deal with the first one?
Let me go to Mr. Monomake's question, because I think I'd like to hear what he provides.
Well, first, I do think that it would have been useful to have an elevation view of the development. I think, one, first of all, the district is very, very excited and pleased about this development, really adding to the both the street life and the activity in this part of the city. I do know the deputy mayor has been working pretty closely with the developer, and I think that one of the reasons why I think it's in our best interest to move forward is it certainly because of the financing issue that the developer has, a timing issue. I think that factor is going to help negotiations on a solution as it relates to the parking. And I do think if you could go back to a couple of slides, the aerial view of the site, there's certainly no lack of surface parking available in the area there. So I do think there's really abundant opportunity for WMATA, the city, to work with the developer to identify other portions of surface parking area that we could come to agreement with a private operator to maybe directly enter into agreement to provide for it. So I don't think we're going to lose much, if any, of the parking. The Home Depot, to the east. I don't think I've ever seen that parking lot full. Again, the commuter parking lot across the way is one option. It is key that if we do use any of these remote sites, that a reasonable level of service for the shuttles is developed, so we can make sure it's an option that really works for the riders. I do want to touch on a couple of other things I think that came up, the security issue, which I think is really critical for all of us. The city is building a bike trail, the Metropolitan Branch Trail, along the CSX right away, right along the Metrorail station. One of the elements is going to be a bridge that will connect the trail itself directly to the station. That's the bridge that you mentioned. In the interim, the city is going to work to make that CSX crossing safer, so we're not having the same issues that we're dealing with today, and just encourage people to walk a safe route. But again, Mr. Berry, to your point, I think there's lots of opportunities there. We are in conversation with the developer, and I think we can come to a solution that works both for the city and for the authority.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
And not to prolong this, obviously the district supports this project 1,000%. But it seems to me that, and I agree with you about options greater than that, the staff can put them on the table. I'm just trying to get at the process. Seems to me the staff should have given us four or five different options, including what you just talked about. So at least we'd be, you happen to know, and I happen to know that area. The other board members may not know that area. So it's just a sort of commentary about process, and I certainly support this, but just a question of how we in the future get more broader options on it.
Mr. Berry, we have before us identified options, and I'm not sure that there is anything that's prohibiting other options to be explored, but I think the question before us is whether or not we move forward with the approval for these agreements and explorations in order to reach some agreement to move forward in the development of the garage. So. That the motion on the table is to move approval, including the options that was placed on the table before.
Right.
Mr. Monomake, any addition? Any other? Yes, Mr. Zimmerman.
I just want to say I have to comment that I think we're discussing exactly the wrong problem here. This is about worrying about whether parking spaces we now have at a metro station will be maintained continuously through a construction period. My view, they shouldn't be there at all. Problem here isn't too little parking, it's too much parking. You saw the picture and the point Mr. Monument made. This is a foolish use of urban land. Land near a transit station could be used in a way to maximize its value for walking trips and other ways for people to get to a station rather than bringing cars into the neighborhood. So, you know, the question, were it my jurisdiction, had I, you know, looking at this more closely than I feel obliged to do as someone from another jurisdiction, I probably would have been asking the staff, what is the current bus service? Why does this presentation not show a map of the buses that bring people here? And do we need to do something to enhance that bus service with the parking we're eliminating, hopefully permanently? The fact that the project include, which has a lot of good qualities, has above ground structured parking is not something I feel good about at all. The idea that some of that above ground structured parking is supposed to be permanently so that commuters can drive into the district to get onto the train doesn't make any sense to me from a regional standpoint or a local standpoint. But that's just my opinion.
And it sounds like we're ready to vote.
Mr. Chairman, along those same lines, what are we doing to educate people about existing bus routes that were mentioned as alternatives? Because this actually could be an opportunity for us to change the mindsets that Chris is speaking about because we're eliminating parking for a short period of time. Maybe we can permanently get them in the mindset of traveling other ways. What are we doing to promote that?
It's our intent. We will communicate and do a marketing effort to notify them of all their options way before the parking is removed.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions?
275.
What is it?
275 residential units.
So I can make that point. There are going to be at least 275 people, maybe if average occupancy is 150, 400 or something, who are going to live here now at the station. So 150 spaces.
This is a motion on the table. I think we've heard the sentiment, and we have two District of Columbia folks sharing their viewpoints for us to consider in this vote. So all those in favor of a motion from the floor. We're not choosing them. Yeah, they've asked to not have her choose an option.
We're giving them flexibility.
That's exactly right.
So, I mean, we can frankly end up where Mr. Zimmerman's talking about.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? All right. Thank you very much. The last item on our the item is an information item, and it is the Jackson Graham building relocation analysis that was requested by the board to come back to us. And we have.
I want to introduce.
Sergeants, I think, yes. Mr. Bottenheimer will introduce it, and Eric Smart, the consultant, will make the presentation.
Board requested late last fall, as Committee Chair Hudgens mentioned, that staff obtained an independent consultant to assess the economics of the sale or relocation of the Jackson Graham building. We retained the firm of Boland Smart to do this. They've been working together with the jurisdictions on the preparation of the scope of work, identify make sure that the analysis that we did was complete and reflected the jurisdiction's desires, and also to identify any locations for which a particular feasibility assessment was requested. The consultants completed that. They're ready to present it, and I want to introduce Eric Smart, managing principal from Boland Smart.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. Yes, we're real estate advisors based in the district. What we were asked to do was to look at two primary scenarios: the sale of the Jackson Graham building, what would the net proceeds for that be, and how could that what could that pay for in terms of relocating out of this building. WMATA suggested that two examples be used as the recipient locations, and that's at the Anacostia Metro Rail Station and at the New Carrollton Metro Rail Station. I emphasize that the instruction that we had was to look at these scenarios and to see how it would pay for itself without requiring other assumptions or other funding. The primary question associated with valuing this building is what is special regarding this building compared to some other building that doesn't have the kind of metro characteristics. Listed here are five primary examples of why this building is different than a generic office building that might be on this location. The building was built in the early 70s, very specific use, not just as a building, but the support it provides to the Metrorail system. Obviously, not, I think all of you know, the tunnel goes right underneath it on the third level. And you can see it downstairs. It's enclosed, fortunately, but there are air shafts that surround this building supporting the immediate tunnel requirements. A very significant one also is there are three chillers, not just one as you find in the support stations, but three on the roof supporting three of the nearest Metrorail stations. Very significant operational consideration. We were looking at the financial implications of if something had to be done with those. The last two points are, of course, there's other operational items, fiber optic systems, rooftop antenna, which are significant but of less costly nature. Those are the metro specialty assets, which I just described. There's too much on this particular slide for me to go through each point unless you have a question. But as far as what are the redevelopment issues for this existing building? Summarize them. Well, the bold face at the top indicates that if WMATA moves away from this building, it triggers a whole series of needs associated with updating the building for another tenant or demolishing the building, whatever might be the way to get a new user to be able to support the value of the underlying real estate. There's really three points that I can summarize in these redevelopment issues. One is that as built from 35 years ago, the building now for market purposes is not ideal. Other users have different needs, the configuration, and I could go into those, but it's certainly the observation and borne out by real estate commentators who've looked at it. Second point is that there are many construction challenges above and beyond, or but related, but above, beyond simply the specialty assets that were aforementioned related to the metro system function. And third, that any redevelopment that requires tearing the building down or even expanding it will trigger an involved rezoning process. This doesn't mean that it's a substantial hurdle. It's a technical path that would have to be pursued and not to be assumed in terms of necessarily what would finally be approved. We've looked at all three of these. The redevelopment options, touched on them primarily already, renovate the existing building for office use. That's moving WMATA to another location. Expand the building for office use. That would constitute perhaps pushing off the edges, but from a rezoning analysis, that's more problematic. The easier approach would be to add two or three floors to the top, which has been common practice where it's been feasible in other parts of downtown of recent. Demoing the building and building a new one, and not to be overlooked, all possible alternative uses for either the existing structure or non-office uses. And from an economic return standpoint, you quickly draw the conclusion that office use in some form, either new or continued or expanded, provides the highest economic value to Metro in order to support its funding requirements under a relocation. Market value then is a starting point given the qualifying factors which I've identified. The note here says value vacant at the top and unencumbered by specialty assets. I have to emphasize that this is looking at the building as if those metro specialty assets are not a factor. I think that's the starting point, and then deduct if there is anything appropriate to that has to come be put against the value of that unencumbered building to figure out what the net proceeds would be. The property we've shown here, a range, the second column, whether the building is as is worked with, whether there's expanded, or whether it's demolished. And you can see a range, an estimated range of $90 to $120 million. You can see over in the far column that it's approximately 300,000 square feet, a little bit more today, gross square feet above the basement. And 400,000 square feet is estimated to be the maximum under the most optimum consideration of what rezoning might permit. That's a combination of height and setbacks from the existing streets. So, I mean, just before turning there, I'm sorry, keep in mind that that's the, if nothing else had to be considered, an estimate of a range of value. All of this, I think, I'm sure all of you appreciate, is a range. There's no precise assumptions that can be made, and we need to pull together as many of those and see what the deltas are when you add them up. Relocation assumptions. The instructions are summarized in the top, where the assumptions that guide how WMATA would structure this are at the top bullets. For analytical purposes, we're assuming that WMATA, like it owns this building, will own the relocation building. The relocation I described before, to a metro, an owned property at a metro rail location. And are there savings associated with moving from this building? One of them is the possibility of reducing the square footage that's required. Smaller but more efficient building. Not by getting rid of staff, but by having a more contemporary property and one that benefits from the investment that knows what your conditions are now rather than from 35 years ago. The numbers. I'll just go through and make sure hopefully they're understood. The first column is the cost of just building a plain vanilla office building so that you can move into it. The turnkey is that you arrive and it's there ready to be occupied for your conventional office requirements. $80 to $90 million using current budgets, and that's not including the land, but that's everything there, the construction, the soft costs, getting it ready for you. The second row says there are going to be contingencies associated with this. At least that's certainly been most agencies' experience, and we've suggested here a 10% to 15%. Either maybe it comes in the form of construction cost increase or design requirements, all the kind of overlays that occur with a large project of this sort, and one which I'm sure you're mindful of that's subject to a lot of different people's inputs. Station reconfiguration. In the back, there's a supplement that shows where these properties could be located on the Anacostia or New Carrollton station recipient locations. But there's no place just to have it land without any impact on what facilities are there now, either in terms of bus ingress and egress, the transfer, whether there is any parking or whether the parking has to be replaced or is important, what have you. There's an impact at the recipient locations, which we've quantified here as $5 to $10 million, which that's for physical costs, and also, though, it needs to consider staging. If you have to, like we had the slides before, you have to move them and move them back. So there's exposure, if I could call it that, with respect to relocation costs associated with maintaining the station. Move costs, furniture and equipment, I think we can be sure it's not going to be as low as $5 million to move everybody and the furniture that they would be requiring and the cabling and all the stuff that is associated with lifting you up and landing you somewhere else. Be probably a lot more expensive than that, but we've put a placeholder of $5 million. Backup Operation Control Center. This is an estimate that WMATA provided for us, which reflects that there is the major Operation Control Center very close to us in this building. And if this building isn't here anymore or is in control of someone else, how is that capability going to be served? How is it going to be replicated? So a estimate of $16 to $19 million is a necessary consideration associated with what are the true costs of leaving this building and making a home somewhere else. What does that add up to? As you said before, it's not precise. There's a number of variables, but if you just take the minimum costs, it adds up to $116 million, rounded off to something, but well over $100 million. To a possible cost of $140 million or more, given that any one of these variables can vary even more than we've suggested. It's a pretty wide band, but you have a complicated relocation to contemplate here. The final slide, it tries to take the summary of the valuation for the sale of this property and overlay it with the relocation cost. Now, the first, I do want to bring your attention, though, to two items that weren't we haven't discussed so far, and that's the third column and the fourth column, or second and third, depending on how you count it. Extra construction cost row, excuse me, extra construction costs and chiller relocation under the sale revenue. So, if I come down that second column, it says sale revenue. We spoke before, $190 to $120 million value, unencumbered by WMATA kinds of things. Extra construction costs, $3 to $10 million, because if you are going to do something substantial with this building, you have to be mindful that there is the tunnel underneath, requires special foundations, transfer beams. It's not a conventional construction project in terms of demo. The list goes on in terms of unusual characteristics associated with this particular property. The chiller relocation, the number, the established number from actually a while back was $15 million. We scaled it back. That means if you have a new building here, what do you do with the chillers? Do you move them to properties nearby? Do you temporarily try and put them somewhere and then put them back on the top? The $15 million plus number there for relocation was an estimate from a couple of years ago that took the position, well, maybe it's better just to relocate them. We scaled that back some to say maybe there's a hybrid, maybe there's kind of an in-between solution. So you come down that column and you get the next item in terms of sale revenue. Maybe it's a relocation cost, but we put it as what do you end up with the revenue? While the building is being built somewhere else, you've got to be somewhere. You've got to be here. And we didn't factor in that you're going to get to keep the building for free during the period of time. Someone would have bought it for $90 to $120 million. They would have been able to do what they wanted with it. But now you're in the building still while you're staging to be located. So a $15 million or $5 million a year is the minimum cost that we think you could negotiate kind of break even with a purchaser in order to stay in the facility. So a deduct, you get three deducts from the $120 million or $90 to $120 million. The extra construction cost, the chiller relocation, and that you've got to be somewhere during the period while the building is being built. What does that net you down in the second last row? $70 to $95 million. So the $90 to $120 million, in effect, in terms of the money you get from a entity that would take an interest in this net, would be $70 to $95 million. Then we move to the third column, the relocation cost. We've discussed those points in the prior slide, and you can see them just summarized again there. So if we go down into the lower corner over here, the right-hand lower corner, add up the revenues and add up the costs, and they're negative. And they're not just when we look at these things, we figure you're not going to hit it on by any better than 20%. And you do your best job, and you're going to have a collar of what you really end up doing of some sort of a 20% number between what you might estimate and where you come in, above or below. You can see here that at $20 million to $70 million of net loss associated with taking the revenue to the relocation costs, even under the best consideration of the highest revenue of $120 million and the lowest relocation cost of $116 million, with the deducts, I should say that I misspoke there, of the net proceeds of $95 million under the sale, and the lowest cost of relocation costs at $116 million, you still end up in the hole by $21 million, which is more than 20%. So my reason for referencing the 20% is, what if we're wrong on these and it actually doesn't, it fits more tight than that? Well, the delta, the difference here, exceeds 20%, so we think it's a number that you can have some confidence in. And that's optimum. Highest revenue, lowest cost. The following three slides, they show some I would suggest going there, but they show where the location would be. And the third last slide is, we also went through a validation research process. I shouldn't say validation. We didn't pose the numbers, but we did interview the real estate community with questions that related to these very issues. Thank you.
Ms. Hudgens, if I could just mention that the presentation that was mailed out, two of the pages were updated and they're in your book, but not in the presentation, but they're consistent with the presentation that was just made.
They're not in the book.
That page.
We don't have that page.
They're in the
book. So it's easy to walk through and see the chain.
I think they're in the packet.
It's inside there.
If I could, the only difference there, WMATA was trying to update their estimate on the operations control center. That's the only difference with respect to the.
I figured out where it was. Yeah.
Mr. Bonamay has a question.
No. First, let me say thank you, Mr. Smart, for the presentation. This has certainly been an interest that's been pretty well documented on behalf of the District of Columbia. We want to get our arms and legs and interests, our minds around this issue, so I appreciate your presentation. And I do thank you for the thoughtful way that the analysis was done. But as my economics teacher would always tell me, assumptions are everything. And starting with the assumptions, you kind of know where you're going to end up. So I'd like to spend some time on the assumptions page 7, and kind of talk through some of the assumptions that you started with on the analysis. One of the things that we've certainly seen here in the city is that, in spite of the pretty challenging real estate market, the downtown market's been fairly resilient here in D.C. So I want to get a sense of how you came up with the per square foot numbers for the turnkey costs of the building.
Yes. This is the cost to build a new building. And we've got a more detailed, obviously, report that supports this, but without referencing that. The cost of the hard construction is on the order of $150 a gross square foot or so. There is soft costs, in this case not at the conventional private developer extent, because there's less financing. There's no lease-up expense. I believe we had that in around 20%, whereas normally it would be 25% for soft costs. That's the stuff that you don't pay the contractor. And this includes I believe, $60 tenant improvement budget, some contingency, not on design, but on construction. So that's the construct, and I'd be happy to have WMATA provide the backup. But that's taking it by line item, mm-hmm. And also, if you did want to reference maybe if I could go to the slide we did, the third next the final one. It was part of the bottom bullet here, queried to the real estate development community. That's on the relocation number that you asked, I believe, concerning construction.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the assumption that's not special to WMATA. The move costs are in this case around $15 to $20 a square foot or around $4,000 a person. I could go on with the assumptions if you wish, but.
Well, it'd be useful to at least see them. Maybe I'll request staff provide them for a little bit more detailed analysis from our folks in the city. Second question deals with the station reconfiguration costs, primarily bus lanes and parking lanes.
Yes, why don't we go to the two that were at the back there? Back one. This is the case in New Carrollton. Hopefully, you're basically familiar with the. what's on this is the east side of the tracks where the formal station is. There are a number of recipient places, but I think in this is primarily some access, been primarily parking, historically been a targeted place for parking. And if there's a decision not to do parking, that would be separate, but this would constitute replacing hundreds of spaces. I don't recall the number which it is, but that's there. Some, there's less, if we go to the next slide, the prior slide. This is at Anacostia, and you can see, without question, that there's a lot of bus lane issues here. We look to some extent at what would be some technical solutions, but it's a combination of, in this instance, and of replacement and interim, what do you do with it on the interim?
The last question I have is the backup OCC number. Very quickly, what's, I mean, obviously we have a primary that's being constructed out at the Carmen Turner facility. The backup, this was not included in the $80 to $90 million?
No, it's not.
It was not.
No, the 80 to 90 is just an office building.
Okay, and I guess the second question, this is probably more to staff or those more intimately involved, is my understanding is that we certainly have a fairly major project out there that's going to be driving the need for substantial expansion of our existing operations. So if we were not to leave this building, for example, there are costs associated with that project that would be assumed within the agency's program. If we were to implement the Dulles program, there would be an operational control center that would perhaps be funded as far as the full funding grant agreement for that project. Is that included as revenue for this as well, or is that something that we did not consider yet?
I do defer to staff on.
I'm not aware of any conclusion of dollars for the Dulles project whatsoever. I don't believe they were used in the calculation from a cost or revenue offset standpoint. As far as expansion of bus services, the control center that's being built at the Common Turner facility allows for a major expansion of bus services by having additional controls, seats, and controllers there.
I guess I make that statement to make clear. I think we've set a fairly good precedent with the baseball stadium. The district certainly bearing the full cost associated with the location there, the expansion of our program at that location. And so if we're saying that any additional expansion system-wide that's caused by jurisdiction, that the jurisdiction needs to bear that additional cost. So if it's being laid out here as a additional cost for whatever jurisdiction might be interested in having the new facility located, I think that we have pretty clear board policy and direction as to how we treat that additional cost.
Question.
I'm not sure it's as much that as it is ensuring that there is a backup facility so that they're, you know, basically right there where the chief operating officers are in the event that they don't have to travel from that location to New Carrollton or where the Carmen Turner facility is to have access to managing an incident. I think so. The intent was to have a minimally configured backup operations control center where the managers of the system are.
No, your point is made, but let's think about the other way. Let's assume we don't move the headquarters anywhere. We build the Dulles station. Is the district going to pay for that station? Based upon what we've done with the baseball stadium, I think we've said that no, the district is not going to participate.
With the
control center's expansion mm-hmm. to accommodate the new operations right. associated with the Dulles extension. I guess I'm clarifying a policy decision that we made.
I just want to make sure from a construction standpoint exactly what we're doing.
There is funding in the Dulles agreement for the necessary expansion of the control plant to be able to facilitate operations. We've changed to having size of that facility is already larger. The new computer system, the operating system, AIM, that we're now in the process of replacing, has got the capability to expand the food to silver line. So what is intended here and the cost that is in here is really for having a backup center to the Carmen Turner facility in case of failure in Carmen Turner. It's not a full-fledged, large
So let me see if I understand it clearly. So there is funding within the Dulles project for that additional expansion. So we could very well use that funding then to address the costs identified here is 16 and 19 million.
Well, the question no. to be asked is that the backup at the Common Turner Center has to be provided for the entire authority, no matter what the expansion or absent the expansion. So the cost factors that are here are reflecting the backup system that's needed for the overall configuration, reconfiguration, and support of the station. Is that, that's what I was. Any other?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Well, if I could finish up, there's just one more point. I think that it might be useful just kind of follow that same point, revenue associated with the project, because between, in my mind, I'm going to pursue that point further offline. That sounds to me like revenue for this project. Another option is if we're going to be building a new facility somewhere that's potential to lease some portion of the building and generate revenue back to the authority to cover some of the costs. So as part of the analysis, I'd like to know some sense of any revenue opportunities that could come back and fund the cost of the project, either from other funding sources or from the potential lease of portions of the new building, new headquarters that could be built at a location.
So those are two questions that you would like to come back.
Let me make sure I'm clear. Are you clear? Yeah, no, you're not.
Two things. Let me make it really, really clear. I'm not convinced that the Dulles funding does not provide for this line item in this presentation. That's the first thing. I want to understand that. Two, if there's another headquarters to be built, is there potential to build a facility that can then be leased and generate revenue back to the authority to either fund other improvements or pay for the cost of the facility?
So
either through debt being issued, debt being paid off, or other operations.
Meaning if there is additional development potential,
yes,
at Anacostia, for example,
yes,
and you were to sell that land for additional development, would the proceeds from that be available for
the delta of 21 to 69 million? Could that cover debt associated with that? Thank you. No, let me just say, I appreciate that. I'd like to have that conversation offline. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr. Barrett.
In terms of the zoning assumptions, that would affect the value of the property at the Jackson Graham building. What were your zoning assumptions in terms of the maximum amount of zoning?
Yes, if I could contrast it, the current zoning is for special use. Actually, it got converted to more recently to commercial, no, excuse me, for WMATA use. But the density that supports is approved at 6 FAR, which is 6 times the ground area. We work with Holland and Knight to evaluate what would be a hypothetical zoning. To get your question, I just want to contrast it with what's here now. And the maximum that could be estimated was a base of 8 FAR, which is 8 times the existing, 8 times the land area, to, with bonuses included, to 8.4. So that added the 100,000 feet for rezoning to commercial use for private market consumption, which is not provided for in the current zoning provisions. Those were the assumptions to maximize the what could be feasible. What does that involve, though? It involves getting exception on height, because this is, don't have it up here, but it's all part of the judicial square master plan area. And there's arguably at least precedent to go higher. The Verizon Center is at 130 feet. There's some precedent with respect to the other more recently constructed buildings surrounding Judiciary Square. So we thought that you could go higher. The constraint in terms of going above 8.4 as the multiple of the land area, or something more than 20% of what's there now, 25-30% of what's there, what's the building represents now, is being able to go closer to Fifth Street. And I do have, if you're interested, an illustration to show why the collected opinion on this was that the site is limited to how far you could push the eastern side of the present building towards Fifth Street. So that was a limitation with respect to determining zoning potential.
Well, assuming a demolition of this building, is that 8.4 FAR the maximum you can get?
Yes. And I'll just show, if I could quickly, I think just to clear this up.
Here's my problem, I'm sure you remember the board. That we all agree that zoning helps to determine the value of this property. And if the surrounding value zoning, they have Verizon said 130.
Yes, I was trying, I'm sorry.
And the others are higher. Why wouldn't we limit it to 8.4 as opposed to getting a maximum of
that one? Can I go up here for a moment just to try and explain this? No, I can.
Okay, project here.
And another issue is, was the 8.4 the number you use in terms of value we could get for this property?
Do that
and then do that.
this is the subject property, as we would call it here, and this is the setback I was describing from the 50. You walk from the walkway there. And if you step back, you can see, if I step back, all the properties have this setback. So that's what I was trying to describe in terms of the building, there would still be limitations to what. This was investigated in a report that was requested to try and figure what is the maximum possibility that you might assume for it. Without completely reinventing what everyone else has been guided for. Now, I think you also asked the question of the valuation, if it's at 8.4 or 8.
Yes.
Is that correct? We don't need to go to the slide, but if it was a scraped site, the building wasn't there, and someone came along and said, what can we support in terms of an office development on that FAR value? And the best we could do was to say that it was between $200 and $250 an FAR foot there, with nothing on there, just the value of the land. And that was what adds up to the components, whether 100 million or 120 million if you add it onto the top of the building.
Let me just say, I'm not satisfied with I appreciate what you're saying, but I think that we could get a much larger FAR. Because the setback only means setback from the sidewalk going backwards, sort of step down to not crowd the street area. It does not affect ultimately the height, or maybe it's a portion of it could be affected, right?
Correct.
So I'd like to ask him to look further at different scenarios
in terms of
the height.
Well, could I just make sure it's understood that the 8.4 already maximizes the height, though?
That's only because you assume that's in conformity with a desirable height that you said, but you also said there were buildings around here that were much taller than that, right? Another question I'd have is, has this site been designated as a historic site? You mentioned historic. Has it?
I'm sorry, if I could again, I'll just so make sure we're talking about the respective property. This has not been, to my knowledge, your site designated as historic. I mentioned historic issues here as part of what was negotiated with this development. The Verizon Center built an active, the height act. Unless you think
the replacement building could be 130 feet.
Correct.
So your analysis says that if a building is replaced, you would move it as far as the setback allows and as high as the neighboring building. So
correct.
It would be consistent.
130 feet.
That's the case, yes.
Well, I didn't hear that. That's what that got me confused. I didn't think you had gone as high as 130 feet.
Sorry.
Okay, I appreciate that. And the final question, and I don't see this in the chart in place, I don't think. If we were to stay here and upgraded this building just for ourselves, did you do an analysis of what that cost may be?
No, we did not.
I think it's important, Madam Chair, that if this board is to make a wise decision, and I say it's important because we may decide to do nothing. And keep it as it is here. I get the impression that there's a desire to either move some other place or upgrade this building. And if we're going to upgrade, it's going to cost us some money. And so, Mr. Zimmer didn't get frightened by the $21 million because it's going to cost us money anyway. It may not be $21 million, maybe 40, maybe 50. So I have to ask him to do an analysis of what it would cost to stay here. Major upgrade.
That's a question that's been asked.
I think you said before me, but I would like to speak at some point.
Okay. I'm sorry, Jeff. I couldn't see.
What's not reflected in here, and this is a decision for the board, obviously, that wouldn't be a part of the analysis, but it's the perception part of this. Perhaps the most disturbing to me, more than the financial parts. This last week, we've seen some failures of basic capital infrastructure. We know what our urgent capital needs are. And as an elected official, I don't know how we sit here and talk about building a new shiny headquarters building at a time when some of our other systems aren't working at optimal levels. So for me, this is a no-brainer decision. This may be good information to have for a later date at a point in time when Metro has other sustained funding, when our systems are working at maximum capacity efficiently, our escalators work, our rails don't bend in the sun. Some of our other capital needs are met. But to me, this is a no-brainer, even if it was a break-even at this point from a perception standpoint as to how do we explain to our riders how it would be okay to relocate into a new headquarters building at a time when they're sitting in buses without air conditioning or when they're being displaced because of failures in our basic capital infrastructure. So I appreciate the presentation, but as one member of this board, I don't see how we could actually get there, even if this 21 to 69 million number was zero sitting here today in the atmosphere that we have. So that's my opinion looking at this. It is a no-brainer for me. So thank you for the work that's been put into it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess everyone on the board knows I've expressed an interest in this this project for quite a while, this issue. And I thank for the presentation today. I think it was a fine presentation. I have a couple of points to make. One, to the extent that you staff, Metro staff, provide information in response to questions here today or from any board members, I would like to receive that same information. I don't think it's confidential, so you can share it with all board members. The second one, has the Boland report that was prepared been made available to the board members or the jurisdiction, or will it be made available to the board members?
Has not been, it can be.
Well, if you make it available to anyone, I would like a copy as well. I'm not asking
everyone will receive it.
Okay, thanks.
That's selective reading. Okay. Any other questions? I do appreciate this report. The board has been, there has been quite a great deal of interest in getting information should there ever be an opportunity to move forward on this, and I do know and recognize the interest of the District of Columbia. I have one question, though, that the numbers are not do not point out, and it says station reconfiguration, and that talks about reconfiguring to move to a location. What does that say? What does it say about the overall, I call it unintended cost of a relocation of a station that is a primary location there? Does that have any figures? It doesn't give us any, there are no, are there measurable ways of being empirical about that cost, I guess is what my question is.
I believe, yes. We were not asked to look at that. We were just taking the hard numbers.
And I'm not asking.
One last comment, yes. If I can be maybe the first and the last. Mr. Solomon, I haven't received anything that you haven't yet, so you don't have to worry about that. But I do want to make one last comment. I think, and this is to Mr. McKay's comments, I think that Metro historically has been in the business of not only providing transportation service, public transportation services, but also supporting economic development throughout the region at the same time. I don't think it's something that's mutually exclusive. I think we can do both. I think it's our responsibility as board members to make sure that the authority and the staff does do both. And I think that while I understand your concerns, I don't think we should dismiss the opportunity to at least have a robust discussion on how we can do that.
Okay, this was an information item, and we had two questions that staff would provide back to board members regarding this item. But other than that,
question.
Oh, about the scenarios, or no?
No, the
I'm not the keeper of the questions.
Upgrading of this building.
Right. Okay.
Costs. So they were there.
Okay. All righty. Hearing none. Other. I think that's our last item. And you see the agenda for the subcommittee. No discussion. We stand adjourned.